Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Tonight on All In.
Sir, the FBI just came in. I said, what? The FBI who?
The DOJ asks a federal judge to hold Trump's team in contempt of court. Tonight, the latest escalation in the Mar-a-Lago documents case and what it could mean for potential indictments. Then, the president of Peru arrested for an attempted coup. Mass arrests in Germany to stop a far-right coup plot there. Tonight, Congressman Adam Schiff on our former president's escape from justice nearly 2 years after his failed coup. And incredible new details of the prisoner swap that got Brittany Griner out of a Russian prison.
She's safe. She's on a plane. She's on her way home. Brittany will soon be back in the arms of her loved ones.
But All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. We've got big developments in the special counsel's two investigations of former President Donald Trump. The Washington Post has new reporting out tonight. Just a few hours ago, the Department of Justice is asking a federal judge to, quote, hold Donald Trump's office in contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a May subpoena to return all classified documents in his possession. People familiar with the matter tell the Post. Now, a major point of contention arose around the fact the department repeatedly sought an unequivocal sworn written assurance from Trump's team that all the documents had been returned. But Trump's team was unwilling to designate a custodian of records to sign such a statement, despite giving assurances that they handed documents back. Now, this comes on the heels of more reporting from the Post yesterday, which is that an outside company that had been retained by Trump's lawyers found two additional items with classified markings in a West Palm Beach storage unit used by the ex-president. Quote, the search was one of at least three searches for classified materials conducted by an outside team at Trump properties in recent weeks after the raid on Mar-a-Lago back in August. Now, today also marks 1 week since the ruling by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals that overturned Judge Eileen Cannon's bizarre special master appointment. The deadline for Trump to appeal that ruling came and went today, and with silence from Trump's legal team, the special master order was officially vacated. It's done. And all this means that if the prosecutors in Special Counsel Jack Smith's office are not going through the evidence seized from Trump's beach house at this very moment, they almost certainly will before the night is out. And we know that Smith is not wasting any time. As Attorney General Merrick Garland named him special counsel last month, tasking Smith with overseeing the Department of Justice's January 6th investigation and the Mar-a-Lago documents case, Smith was recuperating from knee surgery in the Netherlands. Originally, he was there to work on prosecuting international war criminals. He suffered a bike accident that required hospitalization shortly before the announcement. As far as we know, Smith is still in the Netherlands, likely with a pillow under his knee, unable to fly back to physically be with the teams that now report to him. But that appears to not be slowing him down in the least. Harry Lipman is a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice, former U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania. Mary McCord is a former Acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Department of Justice, a former Assistant U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C., and both join me now. There is a lot to process here. I'm going to start with you, Mary, on just when I read this and I said the Department of Justice is seeking contempt finding. That struck me as a big deal, not the kind of thing that normally happens between the Department of Justice and a party. I mean, how significant is this? How does it strike you?
Well, it strikes me that the Department of Justice is extremely frustrated. I think they have, you know, this has been going on for not just months at this point, but for more than a year of just trying to actually get their arms around the classified documents and feel like they maybe have everything that there is to obtain. And as you know, first this came to the department through, you know, the National Archives getting 15 boxes of records that include classified information that caused the referral, of course, to the Department of Justice. That caused the May subpoena. That's the very subpoena at issue in this contempt request, if there is a contempt request. That resulted in like 36 documents, but that wasn't all, because we know we've had 100 more classified documents found during the search warrant several months later. So, and we know there's been additional searches conducted by Trump's team in the last week and some additional documents found. And I think what the department is trying to do is get some accountability, because right now it seems like the Trump team is avoiding accountability by failing to appoint a custodian of records. And understandably, nobody wants to be that person, because nobody feels like they could ever be confident in signing their name, you know, attesting that all documents had been turned over.
Yeah, it's like the drummer for Spinal Tap. Like, who's going to be the person who's going to be like, I am the person who will vouch under penalty of perjury that Donald Trump is one hundo telling the truth about all of the documents. And the history here is striking, too. Right, Harry? I mean, lawyers did that. Previous lawyers did it, and it was false. And the document exists. We've seen it in court filings of lawyers' attestations, sworn attestations, saying, hey, you've got everything. Those lawyers now have had to retain their own lawyers. In this case, if I understand this correctly, these lawyers won't do it. That's the matter. They simply will say, we've given you what we know, but we're not going to swear it's all of it. Trump's side has taken the position that such a request by the Department of Justice that someone swear to this is unreasonable, that no lawyer could sign such a blanket certification in good faith or advise any client to do so, as opposed to attesting that a search of a given location had been completed in good faith. Some of Trump's lawyers are also wary of making any claim under oath based on Trump's word alone, two people familiar with the matter said. In the end, though, Harry, it's just not clear how you close the loop on this, to Mary's point. Like, who knows if they have all the documents?
Exactly. Look, this is so indicative of who Trump is as a person and a client. Everybody has a custodian of records. Crime bosses have a custodian of records. There's already always someone who can do this. It's only Donald Trump for whom all the lawyers, after, as you mentioned, Christina Bob getting crosswise, now having her own lawyers, is like, no, you do it. You do it. Literally, what you can see is that in the secret proceedings in the D.C. court, they just kept going up there and giving excuses. And this is really an enough is enough kind of motion, as Mary says. And it also tells you something about Jack Smith. They've been, you know, diddled around and getting a more back and forth, little temporizing. And Smith is saying, that is it. Somebody's going to be paying money unless people step up and do just the normal thing of appointing a custodian. This is beyond nuts.
Yeah, and it doesn't help, of course, that so my understanding is there were previous attorneys who were retained, Chris Kyes, I believe, out in Florida, who his pitch, right, was, look, hire someone to search high and low, go everywhere, find what there is. If it's government property, turn it over, and that be the end of it. Now, he was ditched or sort of sidelined, as far as the reporting suggests. That clearly some version of that is undertaken, but then they find two more classified documents, which is like, if you're thinking about putting your pen to paper to a test, is like, well, I don't know if you want to do this. And further reporting for the Washington Post, Mary, on what kind of client they're dealing with here, Trump has misled his own lawyers as to what was in the boxes that were taken from Mar-a-Lago, the Post's reporter. For example, he told some of his team that he possessed only newspaper clippings and personal items in 2021. And those are some of the items, those are the boxes that ended up contained classified markings. So you can't possibly, obviously, trust him in this situation.
I think that's exactly what's happening. You know, anyone around him realizes they can't take that personal risk, because what they're starting to see is that it can have ramifications for them, serious culpability and ramifications for them. And so, you know, I mean, this is part of the sort of exodus of people who are willing to represent Trump. And we're, you know, down to just sort of I hate to use the word the dregs, but in some ways that's kind of where we're at, because it's such a risky proposition for your own personal and professional reputation.
I also have to say, as someone who has, Harry, someone who has skated remarkably close to the line of overt criminal conduct for years, not to say there hasn't been any criminal conduct, because I think there's good evidence there has been criminal conduct, but prosecutable overt cases, this, what he has done with the documents here is just deranged. I mean, it just the constant lying, the ignoring lawyers, not giving it over, mine, up to and including like possible contempt of court, possibly getting an indictment over it. This is just the logical extreme of the entire trajectory of this whole story.
That's it. I mean, it's deranged, but it also has a sort of exquisite quality about Donald Trump, because right. What's happening is even this small thing has fault lines that all go to what? Donald Trump's dishonesty. Everywhere you look, that infects things, even to the simple act. And I just want to stress, this happens every day in court. The most dishonest defendants have a custodian, that no one will be that for this guy. It just shows root and branch and every little right. leaf just has dishonesty dripping off it. And that's who this guy is. Yeah.
So we also today, Mary, with the end of this bizarre special master side plot. B story, where you know, the original order, many found to be lawless. The Department of Justice certainly did. It appeals, and the three-judge panel basically said, this is ludicrous, can't do this. They're not appealing. But it does now mean, just at a sort of logistical level, right? Like, everything now goes to Jack Smith's office that wasn't there before. Is that right?
Well, that's right. Jack Smith will be seeing things for the first time. But remember, before Trump's team went in and got that order from Cannon, the Department of Justice, the investigators and prosecutors had actually looked at everything. And they told right. the court that as one reason why she shouldn't even appoint a special master. Now, then they had this, you know, break where they couldn't use it anymore. First of all, couldn't use anything. And then they went to the 11th Circuit and got permission to use the classified information. But there was still a lot of unclassified, and it will be important for them to have both the unclassified and the classified as they work to develop their case. So certainly I think many of the attorneys that have been on this and investigators since the beginning will be familiar with some of these, and hopefully had been waiting for this moment to kind of match those documents up with witnesses they want to talk to in the grand jury, things they want to show to witnesses, stuff like that. But Jack Smith, he'll be seeing it for the first time.
There's also some other news out of Jack Smith's office. And again, they have these two different cases, which confirmed by Merrick Garland, right, when he announced this appointment. These have to do with the fake electors. And these are subpoenas which have been issued in Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, seeking any and all communications with Trump, his campaign, and a long list of aides and allies, pertaining to the attempts to overturn the election in those states. I have to say, what struck me about that headline, Harry, was those haven't been issued yet. Like, it does seem like that would have been near the top of the list when you were starting to investigate this in some sort of criminal sense in the Department of Justice to get those out the door. But it appears now they're just being issued now.
Well, first, we don't know exactly. And second, we definitely don't know who has had voluntary discussions.
Right.
But if you want people in the grand jury, you issue these. And it's a smart move on his part, it strikes me. And again, bespeaks both his speed and aggressiveness, because these are people who they're going to comply. This is not like a Trump team that's going to have a protracted dispute about even showing up in federal court. And something that is certainly new are the identification of exactly who they had communications with, including these are people who better have their own lawyers. But it's a sort of a who's who of who's getting really zeroed in on Eastman, Giuliani, Sidney Ellis as possible suspects or persons of interest in the phony electors probe.
Right. Harry Lipman and Mary McCord sharing their wealth of expertise inside DOJ and outside of it. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks, Mary.
Pleasure.
Coming up, as other countries crack down on coup plotters, Donald Trump Sr. remains safely in his Florida retirement home without really facing consequences to speak of yet. Congressman Adam Schiff on what should be done ahead.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
As we approach the end of the year and the end of this Congress, the January 6th special committee is setting a schedule for the release of what will be their final report. Chairman Benny Thompson now confirms the committee is planning to publish the report the week after next on Wednesday, December 21st. They're also expecting to make criminal referrals at that time. According to new reporting tonight, they are considering referrals for at least four individuals in addition to ex-President Donald Trump. That reportedly includes former White House Chief of Staff and former member of Congress Mark Meadows, Trump lawyers John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani, Julie Honey, and former Department of Justice official Jeffrey Clark. Now, so far, Chairman Thompson has not been ready to publicly name names.
We have not made a decision as to who, but we have made decisions that criminal referrals will happen. I wish I could tell you 1, 2, 3, 4, but all that's still being discussed.
As the committee continues its work to hold accountable the people who tried to overthrow American democracy on January 6, 2021, we're seeing examples from around the world, just the last 24, 48 hours, of how fragile democracy can be and how seriously these other countries are taking threats to their democratic order. In Germany, for example, police launched a series of raids at dawn yesterday, thwarting an alleged far-right plot to violently attack the parliament. The group, German officials say, was inspired by American extremists and the storming of the U.S. Capitol nearly 2 years ago. They were also influenced by QAnon conspiracy theories about everything from vaccines to the so-called deep state and mirrored some of the same language. Shortly before the raid on Wednesday, one of the suspects posted on Telegram, quote, "Everything will be turned upside down. The current public prosecutors and judges, as well as the heads of the health departments and their superiors, will find themselves in the dock at Nuremberg 2.0. Of course, perhaps more than any other state on earth, Germans know how dangerous this all can be. Last century, its Weimar-era democracy was overtaken by far-right extremists who launched arguably the most murderous government known to humankind. So that's pretty seared into the German memory. Thankfully, this plot was thwarted before the group could execute any of their plans. According to Germany's public prosecutor general, the group had an armed wing that included former military and intended to form a new army. Their ringleader, who they plan to install as the monarch, is a 71-year-old aristocrat named Heinrich XIII. He comes from an ancient royal family that ruled part of central Germany for centuries. In a tradition dating to the 1100s, the family names all male heirs Heinrich, followed by a number, and they go all the way up to 100, and then they start over. So now, Heinrich XIII, who you're looking at there, has been arrested, along with 24 other members of his group, who Germany's interior minister called, quote, enemies of democracy. She also said the government would respond against such plots with the full force of the law, which, of course, makes sense. Now, the same day, the very same day, halfway around the world, the other hemisphere, another democratic crisis was brewing. This one in Peru, where the president, Pedro Castillo, faced an impeachment vote and went on TV to announce he was going to dissolve the legislature. He said there would be new elections and a new constitution. His vice president and the Supreme Court called it a coup attempt. Plainly, it was. Several members of his cabinet resigned immediately. Now, Peru has its own reason to be worried. It's long had a fragile democracy struggling against both armed rebels for decades, as well as the authoritarian aspirations of various elected leaders, not to mention corruption. Within just 3 hours of the current president's attempt to overthrow the government, the legislature overwhelmingly voted to impeach President Castillo. He was removed from office. He was then taken into police custody and accused of rebellion and conspiracy. In a statement, federal prosecutors said that they condemned the violation of constitutional order and added, quote, no authority can put itself above the Constitution. Brings us to our own country, where I have to say it remains just astounding to me that the man who plainly attempted to end the American constitutional order, who on live television fomented a violent insurrection against the rightfully elected government to install himself in power over the will of the people, is just chilling at his retirement home in Florida, from where he essentially runs the entire Republican Party. He is running for president again. He is the only declared candidate for president again. Other countries, like Germany and Peru, democracies like ours, recognize a threat to their constitutional and democratic order when they see one. It sure does seem like they take it way more seriously than we do. And I think part of the reason for that could be that they're way less complacent about how resilient democracy is, how much of a threat someone like Donald Trump can be. But I'm going to talk to someone who's decidedly not complacent and has been working very hard for several years now to hold Donald Trump accountable for his actions. Congressman Adam Schiff, former impeachment manager, a member of that January 6th committee, joins me next. So there's a whole host of legal problems facing Donald Trump Sr. right now, from his own lawyers facing contempt, to the dismissal of the special master he wanted for his Mar-a-Lago document stash, to the looming final report from the January 6th committee. While committee chairman Benny Thompson says they are still deciding who will be the targets of their criminal referrals, we know that one possible target is, of course, ex-president Donald Trump himself. As I pointed out earlier, he still hasn't faced any legal consequences for his role in the insurrection, even though other countries, Germany, Peru, act decisively and quickly to quash attempted coups, to arrest the ringleaders who aim to overturn their democracies. Our own ex-president has yet to face any charges. Joining me now is a member of the January 6th committee, Congressman Adam Schiff, Democrat of California and chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Congressman, it's good to have you. I want to start to see if you could confirm some news. CNN reporting the committee is considering referrals for four individuals besides the ex-president. Those include White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, John Eastman, Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, and former Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani. Can you confirm that?
You know, what I can tell you, Chris, is our process. We've looked at the evidence. We've looked at, what individuals we believe there's evidence to support potential referrals. We looked at, each of the elements and matched it with the evidence. And, we're not ready to announce anything. We will with our report. But we're not confining our examination just to the president or anyone else. And we'll be, making our findings known fairly soon.
I wonder if you could speak at least, and you don't have to speak for others, but at least for yourself, the trajectory of your thinking on this specific issue. It has been the focus, I think, of a fair amount of coverage, and I think largely because obviously everyone understands this is not a criminal body, so they understand that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, understand that this is probably the most thorough investigation of these events that's happened, which appear to many to be plainly criminal. So the way that circle is squared is, will the committee refer? Talk me through your own thinking about the significance of these referrals.
We start out by examining the sort of history of when Congress makes referrals. And generally, it's for things like contempt of Congress or lying before Congress. Here, you had an attack on Congress. Right. So to me, this involves, a core interest, obviously, of the Congress to be able to execute its lawful functions. It involved, trying to stop the peaceful transfer of power. We were, I think, way out ahead of the Justice Department in the investigation for a long time. There are areas where we probably still are and areas where they're out ahead of us. We weighed the effect of a referral. It's obviously not required of Congress, and the Justice Department theoretically could view it in a couple different ways. They could view it as helpful, pointing out the evidence and the statutes, or they could view it as making it more difficult by giving it a suggestion that it's somehow political. Right. But I think what we've, at least certainly what I believe is that we have an independent responsibility, no matter what the Justice Department may do, when we believe that impeachable offenses have been committed, no matter what the Senate may do, we have to do our responsibility. And so I think there's a fair degree of consensus around that. And we'll be announcing, you know, what form that takes very soon.
Yeah, there is obviously now the special counsel. There's an independent or quasi-independent process that's set up for these investigations, which we now are publicly confirmed under one ambit. Do you find that encouraging? And have you been generally encouraged that? Are you generally confident they will get to the bottom of it?
I actually think that the appointment of special counsel was good. He looks like a very experienced prosecutor. He looks very serious and will be focused on this, entirely focused on this. And I think that's positive. The only concern I had, and that concern seems to be now that we see what he's doing, without a lot of basis, is was this going to delay things?
Right.
Was he going to have to come up to speed, or would he be able to bring over both the prosecutors who worked on this previously, as well as the work product? It certainly appears from the subpoenas that have gone out, even in the short time since he was appointed, that no time has been lost. So you get all the benefit of a special counsel, their dedicated focus, an experienced prosecutor, someone who will make recommendations to the attorney general that will be very hard for the attorney general to refuse, someone who's aggressive. I think there's a lot to be said for it. And he's also giving fresh eyes to this. I've been frustrated for some time that certain allegations don't appear to be the subject of DOJ investigation, like the former president's efforts in Georgia, the infamous call to find me 11,780 votes. And I would hope that he, if that's not currently part of what they're examining, will say, hey, why aren't we looking at this? Why are we leaving this to a local county district attorney, even one who's very capable?
There's a question now about another set of actions the committee might or might not take vis-a-vis referral, which is several colleagues of yours that have been subpoenaed by the committee and essentially ignored that subpoena. What to do about that? There's some talk about whether there would be a criminal referral there for contempt of Congress. But of course, this is all pretty dicey and uncharted territory, I think it's fair to say, and also happening on the eve of the majority switching, right? I mean, you're going to be on the other end of this in the 3 weeks. How do you think through that?
Well, you know, we have had to wrestle this question continually, which is, should we do the right thing knowing that the Republicans, when they take over, might use the precedent to do the wrong thing? My feeling is we do the right thing. And so we're examining what is the right way to treat members who are, you know, contemptuous of a committee in Congress, unwilling to meet their obligations to the public. I think there's reluctance to try to get some other institution, some other branch of government to police our own. So this is what we're wrestling with. Congress really ought to police its own, but what does that look like and how do we accomplish that? So this is what we're determining. And again, we'll be letting the public know shortly what conclusion we've reached and how we think accountability ought to take place.
Finally, on that question of accountability, I spoke earlier in the show about some of the international headlines we've seen over the last few days in Germany, where what appears to be essentially seditious plot to overthrow the government was exposed and rounded up and arrested. In Peru, in which the president announced essentially a coup and was swiftly within police custody within a matter of hours. How you think we fare in the level of accountability that has been brought to bear on those who aided and abetted what was, you know, a violent attempt to overthrow the constitutional order, unprecedented in its form in the long history of the nation?
You know, I think the jury is still out, and maybe the jury is still out because the jury hasn't been called in for many of these cases yet. We're almost 2 years, Chris, since these events took place, and that's a long time to do these investigations. Many of them should have been done by now. And so I think we'll have to see, do we have accountability of the kind the attorney general announced at the outset of this investigation, where everyone is equal before the law, or by virtue of being a former president or politically powerful or relevant, do you get to escape accountability? So I think it's still TBD, to be determined. But looking at these events in Peru and in Germany, one thing is very clear, and that is the threat to democracy at home and abroad is not over. These QAnon conspiracies, in Germany and in the United States have so much in common with their deep state dark fantasies, with the strands of anti-Semitism woven through them, and other despots and would-be despots in places like Peru. Look at the president of the United States, the more foremost democracy in the world, trying to stay in power, engaging in illegal, if not corrupt acts, corrupt and illegal acts. Sadly, look at the former president as an example to be followed, not an example to be shunned.
All right, Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Still to come, after nearly a year in Russian custody, WNBA star Brittany Griner is finally free. Ben Rhodes on what it took to get her back ahead.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Over 26 years ago, Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, as it would come to be known. A law that defined marriage as a union of one man and one woman, denied same-sex couples the federal protections and privileges of marriage. At the time, Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Barney Frank was one of the only two openly gay members of Congress. Back then, he took to the floor to oppose the bill.
I have asked member after member who is an advocate of this bill, how does the fact that two men live together in a loving relationship and commit themselves in Hawaii threaten your marriage in Florida or Georgia or wherever? And the answer is always, well, it doesn't threaten my marriage and it doesn't threaten his marriage. It threatens the institution of marriage. That, of course, baffles me some. Marriages, institutions don't marry. They may merge, but they don't marry. People marry. Human beings. Men and women who love each other marry. And no one who understands human nature thinks that allowing two other people to love each other interferes.
Pretty persuasive. More than a quarter century later, now former Congressman Barney Frank was back on the floor of the House today to watch Congress get rid of that law.
I was here for the birth of DOMA, so I am very grateful to be able to be here for the funeral, and it's kind of a New Orleans moment. We are tooting our horns for the funeral, a much happier occasion than the birth.
The Respect for Marriage Act, which codifies federal recognition of same-sex marriages and formally repeals DOMA, has now passed both the Senate and the House. It was the right-wing Supreme Court's threat, particularly Clarence Thomas's threat, to overturn Obergefell, the case that legalized same-sex marriage, that prompted lawmakers in both houses to take action. The bill now goes to President Joe Biden's desk, where he will sign it. But while 39 Republicans joined Democrats in passing the bill, 169 House Republicans, the majority of the caucus, voted no. And some members of that caucus took to the floor to literally cry about it.
Traditional biblical marriage is the foundation of a strong society and a strong culture. I'll say it once again. Almost everything that plagues our society is a failure to follow God's design for marriage, morality, and the family.
The Democrats want Americans to believe that the Supreme Court at any moment, in fact, the chairman just referenced this, at any moment could step in and overturn its opinions in Obergefell and Loving. It's just not true. This bill is simply the latest installment of the Democrats' campaign to intimidate the highest court in our land.
Protect Americans who believe in the true meaning of marriage. I hope and pray that my colleagues will find the courage to join me in opposing this misguided and this dangerous bill.
That's a shame. And this bill is signed by President Biden. It will, once and for all, formally consign the vile law that is DOMA, the one that Barney Frank spoke out against so many years ago, to the ash heap of history. Time for the best news of the day. After spending nearly a year in prison in Russia, what the State Department called a wrongful detention, WNBA star Brittany Griner is on her way back home. Griner was scheduled to play basketball in Russia during the American offseason, but she was arrested at the Moscow airport in February after accidentally bringing medical marijuana vape cartridges to Russia with her. She was sentenced to 9 years in a Russian penal colony for that crime, as the U.S. spent months trying to negotiate a deal for her release, while Britney's wife, Sherelle Griner, and many others lobbied relentlessly on her behalf. Well, today, they finally succeeded, with Russian state media releasing this video of Griner leaving custody. For its part, the White House released these photos of Sherelle Griner in the Oval Office with the president, speaking to Britney on the phone. And both the president and Sherelle Griner addressed the public after the deal was announced.
She's safe. She's on a plane. She's on her way home. After months of being unjustly detained in Russia, held under intolerable circumstances, Brittany will soon be back in the arms of her loved ones, and she should have been there all along.
Today is just a happy day for me and my family, so I'm going to smile right now. thank you.
Sherelle Griner, you saw there, will be reunited with her wife soon when Brittany lands at an Army base in San Antonio, Texas, for a medical evaluation. Now, the deal was part of a straight-up one-for-one prisoner swap. You can see it there, happening on the tarmac. The man you see there being swapped for Griner is infamous, Victor Boot, a notorious arms dealer nicknamed the Merchant of Death. Boot was arrested back in 2008 after trying to sell a cache of weapons to men he thought were Colombian revolutionaries who said they wanted to use the guns to kill U.S. citizens. He served 11 years of a 25-year sentence here in this country on charges which included conspiring to kill Americans. The deal comes at a particularly perilous time, of course, for U.S.-Russian diplomacy. Griner was arrested 1 week before Russia invaded Ukraine. The Biden administration found itself in the unenviable position of negotiating her release while also drawing a hard line against Russia for its geopolitical belligerence. The White House was hoping to negotiate a deal that also included the release of another American, Paul Whelan, an American security executive, serving 16 years in Russian prison on charges of spying, which the U.S. denies. But Russia would not agree to Whelan's release. Nor did the deal secure the release of Mark Fogel, a Pennsylvania teacher is currently serving a 14-year sentence at a Russian penal colony for similar charges of bringing medical marijuana into the country. Unlike Griner and Whelan, the U.S. has not designated Fogel as wrongfully detained. Ben Rhodes served as Deputy National Security Advisor under President Barack Obama, and he joins me now. Ben, I'm curious your perspective. I know that while you were in the White House, you were involved with some negotiations that happened, I believe, in Cuba. How this looks from inside a White House. This is the kind of thing that really only presidents can do. It's incredibly dicey and difficult and fraught. How does this work inside a White House, trying to get wrongfully imprisoned Americans back home?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. And usually it has to be done from the White House because that's where you have the authority to execute a swap. There's also usually a lot of secrecy around the diplomacy and negotiation. But also because anytime you have a swap like this, no side gets everything they want. So I'm sure that the U.S. coming into this desperately wanted to get Brittany Griner home, as well as Paul Whelan, probably did not want to start with Victor Boot. So there's a period of time where you have to figure out how far you're willing to go or willing to let someone like Victor Boot go. And then from watching this from the outside, it seems like they were trying to get Paul Whelan home as a part of this. But the Russians were making certain demands and essentially insisting that the U.S. view Paul Whelan as a CIA or intelligence operative of some point, and that made it impossible. So it's a hard process in a White House because you really want to achieve the objective, but the price of achieving that objective is always going to be high, because in any kind of prisoner exchange like this, both sides are going to have to give something up that they don't want to.
You mentioned Paul Whelan. I want to play this, what his brother had to say. I thought the family's statements on this were very moving and incredibly gracious. This is what his brother had to say on Andrea Mitchell's show earlier today.
I think President Biden made the right decision. His job is to protect all Americans and to care about all Americans. And it would have been wrong for him to leave behind an American when he had the ability to bring them home. And so I appreciate that he may have even waited. He may have even delayed in a hope that Paul might have been able to come home. But it was absolutely the right decision to bring Ms. Greiner home. And I'm so glad that he did. I'm super excited that she's free and able to spend the time with her family.
How do the negotiations work? Like, literally, who is the person doing it on each side? Since it's not going, you know, there are normal state-to-state channels that go through the State Department or go through the ambassador. Like, how does this even get set up, the kind of side channel to negotiate this kind of thing?
No, it's a good point, Chris, because in any circumstance, you usually wouldn't discuss something this sensitive through kind of normal embassy channels, right, through our ambassador there. When relations are strained, as they are in the case between the U.S. and Russia, those channels are broken down anyway. So you literally need to kind of construct some channel that can go directly from President Biden to, in this case, President Putin. Right. This is not something you're going to be doing in the bowels of the foreign ministry in Russia. And so it's a matter of finding people close to both presidents who can be seen to be speaking for both presidents, who are able to be empowered to make proposals here. And in this case, I do think it does feel like they were trying to get Paul Whelan home as a part of this. And so you can go back and forth and back and forth passing proposals about different types of people that you might exchange. And I'm sure the Russians wanted all manner of people that we don't want to let out of either U.S. or allied custody in return. But it's a sensitive series of discussions. And we've seen, again, that in the past, sometimes you use discussions about prisoner exchanges to set up a channel that can be enlarged to discuss other subjects. I think in this case, that's very sensitive because the Ukrainians obviously don't want us talking about the war in Ukraine with Russia without them at that table.
Well, and this is what was, you know, this is the horrible tragedy here, right? She is arrested 1 week before the invasion and before the entirety of the bilateral relationship completely falls apart. I mean, you know, international journalism organizations, including our own, had to get their people out. I mean, it suddenly became an acute threat to have Americans in Russia under any conditions. She happened to be caught in the maw of this, and is now thankfully home. But I wonder what it means for U.S.-Russian diplomacy generally. I guess the question is, how much does this end up on a parallel track?
I think for U.S.-Russia diplomacy, it does demonstrate that you can have channels of communication to address sensitive issues and come to an agreement. And then that each side delivered on their agreement. You know, Victor Boots on his way to Russia. Brittany Griner, thankfully, is on her way home. And that is an important determination because there are going to be a lot of things to talk about, Chris, with the Russians, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
Not just the outcome of the war in Ukraine, you know, a global food crisis, all manner of other crises that could happen, you know, nuclear escalation to be avoided. And so I think this does show that there are lines of communication, sensitive lines of communication that can be returned to for other purposes if we're absolutely going to have to be passing messages back and forth to the Kremlin.
I remember when I was covering the release of Bo Bergdahl, American service member who was in Taliban custody, who was brought home by the Obama administration. There was, like, you would expect celebration. There's this huge backlash, right? He had been accused of deserting. There was anger. There was outrage on Fox News. I was a little surprised, and maybe I shouldn't have been, to see some of that today with Brittany Griner. They don't like her politics. They don't like the fact that Paul Whelan was left behind. Are you surprised that there's, like, backlash on a day when an American who's unjustly imprisoned abroad is back, going to be back in the arms of her family and on safe U.S. soil?
I'm not surprised, Chris. I wish I could say I was, because this is something that all Americans should feel good about. Brittany Griner coming home, her wife being reunited with her. I think Paul Whelan's brother had the exact right sentiment on this. And look, you asked about being in the White House. One of the most difficult things is talking to families. and not being able to give them good news. That's one of the hardest possible conversations you can have. And I'm sure that the Biden administration wanted Paul Whelan home, but if the Russians are insisting he be treated as an intelligence asset, and both Paul Whelan and the U.S. says he's not, and the Russians are probably asking for all manner of their intelligence agents in response.
Right.
Sometimes you can't get to an agreement on these things. All you can do is keep working on it. But I hope tonight what Americans are focused on is what a good news is that Brittany Griner is coming home.
Yeah, it is such good news. Gosh, what a relief. Ben Rhodes, thank you very much. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.